Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are looking at the engine room of the economy. We're stripping down a topic that usually gets covered in layers of political paint, of moral outrage, and we're looking strictly at the mechanics. We are talking about inequality.
And honestly, it is about time you did this one. It's the topic everyone shouts about, but, you know, very few people actually stop to look at the wiring diagram.
Right, okay. Exactly. Usually you turn on the news and it's a debate about fairness or who deserves what?
Sure.
And don't get me wrong, those are valid philosophical questions. But today, I want to show the philosophy. I want to look at the macroeconomics.
Okay.
We're digging into a seminal chapter by Per Krusel and Vygotyar Rozsról that treats inequality not as a political football, but as a variable in the economic machine.
And that's the key shift.
Yeah.
We aren't asking, is it bad? We are asking, how does it work?
Yes.
And maybe more importantly, how does it change the way the economy responds to everything else?
What strikes me as odd, though, reading through the history of this, is that macroeconomists sort of treated inequality as a non-issue for a very long time.
They did.
It just feels like a massive oversight in the modeling.
It was, but it was an oversight born of convenience, really.
Right.
For decades, the standard tool was the representative agent model.
Right.
Basically, to make the math work, economists just assumed everyone in the economy was identical.
So you could average them all out.
You average everyone out into one average Joe and just track him.
Which is fantastic for clean calculus, but, I mean, it's terrible for reality. If I walk down the street in New York or London, it is painfully obvious there's no average experience.
Precisely. But the models held up, you know, until they didn't. The data just started screaming at us in the late 70s and early 80s. The divergence between that average GDP growth and what actual people were experiencing became too wide to ignore. You couldn't just look at the aggregate anymore.
You had to look at the distribution.
You had to.
So let's look at that distribution. We're using the Krusel and Rozsról framework. I want to get a sense of the scale here, specifically in the U.S. around, say, the 2022 mark.
Okay.
We all know the Gironi coefficient is the standard yardstick. Zero is perfect equality. One is one guy owns the planet. Where are we sitting?
Well, this is where you have to be really precise because the journey, it varies wildly depending on what you're measuring.
Okay.
If we look at earnings, so just labor income from your job, the Gini is around 0.68, which is high.
High by international standards.
Very. But that's just the paycheck. The real story is the net wealth number, right? Mm. Assets minus liabilities.
Right.
That is where the graph just breaks. The Gini for net wealth is a staggering 0.83.
Wow.
To translate that into humans, the top 1% of earners take home about 20% of the income pie.
Okay.
But the top 1% of wealth holders, they control 35% of the total wealth.
That distinction is so critical. We often conflate high earners with wealthy, but the data suggests they're two totally different mechanics.
They are. You can earn a lot and burn it all, or you can earn passively and accumulate.
Exactly.
But here's the curveball that I think trips a lot of people up. If you look at consumption, what people actually spend on goods and services, the inequality is much, much lower.
Wait, really?
It's significantly flatter than both income and wealth.
I have to pause you there. Because we see the billionaires buying super yachts, private islands, space programs. The consumption at the top looks astronomical.
It is.
Are you telling me the data says their consumption is flat relative to the rest of us? That just feels wrong.
It's not that their consumption isn't high. It's that it isn't proportional to their wealth. This comes down to something called consumption smoothing.
Meaning they don't spend the paycheck the day it comes in.
Right. But it's deeper than that. Consumption smoothing is the ability to maintain a stable standard of living despite income shocks.
Okay.
So if you're poor and your car breaks down, a transitory shock, your consumption takes a huge hit. You might skip meals to pay for the repair. But wealthier individuals use savings and credit markets to smooth that out. They can borrow against the future.
So the data is showing that credit markets and insurance are actually doing their job, in a way. They're compressing the lifestyle gap, even while the asset gap explodes.
To a degree, yes. But it also implies that the ultra-wealthy have a saturation point.
Right.
You can only eat so many steaks. A billionaire might have 1,000 times the wealth of a middle-class person, but they aren't eating 1,000 times as much food.
Or wearing 1,000 times as many shirts.
Exactly. They save the surplus. And that saving is what fuels the wealth gap.
Which brings up a myth I really want to bust. There is this persistent narrative sort of the Protestant work ethic idea that the wealth gap exists because the top 1% are just grinding harder.
Oh, yeah. The 80-hour week myth.
Right. But the Cusell data doesn't support that at all, does it?
Not at all. Yeah. In fact, the correlation between hours worked and wealth is almost zero.
Zero.
It's effectively non-existent.
So the billionaire isn't working 100 times harder than the janitor?
No. Across the wage bins, hours worked are remarkably flat. The super rich aren't rich because of the quantity of labor. They're rich because of the price of their labor, and more importantly, the returns on their capital.
Okay, let's pull on that price of labor thread, the skill premium.
Mm-hmm.
We know the gap between college-educated wages and non-college wages has just blown up.
Mm-hmm.
But historically, that shouldn't happen.
Right. Basic supply and demand.
If you flood the market with college grads, which we did, the price of a grad should go down.
And that is the great economic puzzle of the 1980s. The supply of skilled workers went up, but the price, their wage, went up even faster. That implies the demand curve just shifted aggressively.
And the usual suspect here is technology. But I want to get specific. It's not just computers exist.
No, no.
It's about how capital interacts with skill. The outline mentions capital skill complementarity.
This is the crucial mechanism. It relies on a concept called the elasticity of substitution.
Break that down.
Think of it this way. In the old days, a machine might replace a worker. But modern capital complex IT systems, advanced robotics, doesn't just replace people. It requires highly skilled people to run it.
So the machine and the skilled worker are teammates.
They are complements. If the elasticity of substitution is low, it means you can't easily swap the skilled worker for the machine. You need both.
I see.
So as equipment gets cheaper and companies buy more of it, the demand for the specific humans who can operate that equipment just skyrockets.
While the demand for the unskilled worker who can be replaced by the machine drops through the floor.
Exactly. And this creates what they call the task-based model of inequality. It's not just top versus bottom.
It's a hollowing out.
It's a hollowing out. Automation is excellent at routine tasks, bookkeeping, assembly lines, middle management. Those jobs are just disappearing.
The classic middle-class stepping stones.
Gone. So the labor market turns into a burrbell. You have high-paid abstract problem solvers on one end and low-paid manual service workers on the other.
Like home healthcare, janitorial work.
Jobs that require dexterity, but not necessarily a degree. The ladder in the middle is missing rungs.
Okay, so that explains the income gap.
Mm-hmm.
The labor market is valuing skills differently. But that doesn't explain the 0.83 wealth genuity.
No, it doesn't.
You can't get to the top 1% of wealth just by saving a high salary. The math just doesn't work.
You're right. The math fails completely if you assume everyone invests the same way. This is where we have to talk about portfolio composition.
This is the return heterogeneity concept. Break this down for me. We aren't just talking about having more money to invest.
No.
We're talking about investing in fundamentally different things.
Correct. Let's look at the portfolio of a typical middle-class family. Their wealth is almost entirely concentrated in one asset, their home.
Residential real estate.
Right. And historically, housing creates stability, but it generates a relatively low real return, maybe 2 or 3% a year after inflation.
Whereas the top 10%, and certainly the top 1%, they are not relying on their primary residence for wealth.
No. Their portfolios are heavy in business equity, private stock, financial assets.
Obscure assets.
They're riskier, yes, but they command a risk premium. They might yield 7, 8, or even 10%. Real returns over long periods.
Okay, let's just run the compound math on that. If I have $100,000 growing at 3% versus $100,000 growing at 8% over 30 years, that is not a small gap.
It's a chasm. It's exponential divergence. The person with the high-yield portfolio ends up with multiples of the wealth of the housing-only saver, even if they started with the exact same amount.
So this return heterogeneity.
The fact that rich people's money creates more money faster than poor people's money.
That's likely the biggest single driver of that 0.83 Jaconda coefficient.
Seems to be.
And the source material brings up a kind of controversial point here about luck. They call it random growth. It sounds almost like a casino theory.
It does a bit, but it's really the Pareto distribution in action. Imagine a coin toss game. If you have millions of people flipping coins for their investment returns, and you play that game for 40 years.
Yeah.
Purely by chance, a small group will flip heads 20 times in a row.
They get the golden streak.
They get the streak. And because of compounding, that lucky streak sends them into the stratosphere.
Wow.
The model suggests that a significant portion of the ultra-wealthy elite aren't necessarily better investors. They are the statistical beneficiaries of random growth over time.
So we have a system where skill bias widens wages and return heterogeneity explodes wealth. Now, I want to pivot to the so what.
Okay.
Because for a long time, the central bank attitude was, who cares how the pie is sliced as long as the pie is growing?
That was the consensus. A rising tide lifts all boats.
But the Cosell and Ra's Rule chapter argues that inequality actually changes the physics of the boat. This brings us to the MPC, the marginal propensity to consume. Why is this three-letter acronym so dangerous for a recession?
This is the single most important concept for understanding why inequality matters to the macroeconomy. MPC asks a simple question. If I give you one extra dollar today, how much of it will you spend?
And as we established with the consumption smoothing idea, that answer depends entirely on how much money I already have.
Exactly. If you are living paycheck to paycheck, what economists call hand to mouth, your MPC is nearly one.
You get a dollar, you spend a dollar.
On rent, on food, whatever. That spending instantly stimulates the economy.
But the wealthy have a low MPC.
Very low. They might spend 5 cents and save 95. Now, think about a fiscal stimulus package during a recession. If the government sends checks to everyone or cuts taxes across the board.
The impact depends entirely on who gets the cash. If you give it to the top 1%, it just disappears into a savings account.
It leaks out of the immediate economy. But if you give it to the bottom 50%, it cycles through immediately. This is the fiscal multiplier.
And in a model that accounts for inequality.
In a heterogeneous agent model, the multiplier is much, much higher for transfers to the poor. Inequality makes the economy more sensitive to targeted policy.
So high inequality could actually dampen the effectiveness of broad monetary policy if the transmission mechanism gets stuck at the top.
It creates a drag. And there's a second, more insidious drag they mention, the human capital trap.
This connects back to the education costs we talked about.
Right. Education is an investment with a high fixed cost. In a perfect world, anyone with talent could borrow money to go to Harvard or MIT, knowing their future wages would pay it back.
But credit markets aren't perfect. You can't just walk into a bank and say, I'm smart, give me 200 grand.
Exactly. You have no collateral.
Yeah.
So in a highly unequal society, you get this situation where high talent individuals in poor families literally cannot afford to invest in their own skills.
And they end up in low productivity jobs.
Right. And that's not just a tragedy for them. That's an efficiency loss for the whole machine. We are leaving GDP on the table because we can't get the capital to the talent.
That is the inequality trap. Aggregate productivity is lower than it should be because the allocation of resources is distorted by wealth constraints.
Precisely.
So when we look at the trade-offs, and there are always trade-offs, the source material isn't arguing for perfect equality, is it?
No. And we have to be clear about that. Perfect equality is usually a disaster for incentives. If you tax every dollar at 100%, nobody works, nobody innovates, nobody saves.
You need the carrot.
But the argument is that we might be too far toward the other extreme.
That high inequality creates these frictions.
Like the human capital trap and the demand drag.
That slow down the very growth we're trying to encourage. The data suggests we are operating inefficiently.
It does.
It reminds me of the veil of ignorance concept they allude to at the end. It's a philosophical check on the economic model.
It's the ultimate stress test. If you had to design an economy, the tax rates, the school funding, the safety nets, but you didn't know who you were going to be in that economy.
You don't know if you'll be the lucky investor with the 10% returns or the worker whose job just got automated by AI.
Right. You don't know your talent, your parents' wealth, or your luck. What system would you build?
I think most rational people looking at the random growth data and the skill bias friction would probably build a system with a bit more insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Not to guarantee outcomes, but to insure against the sheer randomness of the starting line.
It implies a balance between the efficiency of the market and, you know, the insurance against luck. And right now, the macro data suggests the machine might be running a little unbalanced.
It's a fascinating way to look at it.
Yeah.
Not as good versus evil, but as efficient versus inefficient.
Mechanics, not morals. But the mechanics matter.
They certainly do. That's all we have for this deep dive. Hopefully, next time you see a headline about the wealth gap, you'll see the gears turning underneath it. Thanks for listening.
Until next time.